This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hi, I'm Bex.
And I'm Laura.
And we're here to talk openly and honestly about miscarriage, stillbirth, and all pregnancy loss.
We aim to smash the taboo surrounding these subjects.
And rebuild the topic in a way to support and educate women.
Rather than isolate and shame them.
Welcome
to the worst girl gang
ever.
That's a good sign. We're recording.
Do you need me to record my end as well? You don't do that? No, okay.
No, don't you worry. That would make it way more complicated.
We're not very polished.
No, well, that's all the better because I'm always just really anxious I'm doing it wrong. So
no, we're probably doing it wrong. We've probably been doing it wrong for years. Don't worry.
We're winging it.
Good. Well, that's the spirit I'm happy to be involved in. Good. All right. I won't touch anything technical. I'll just talk. Yeah.
Just talk. So, Claire, talk. Tell us what brings you to being a member of the worst girl gang ever. Oh, hang on. We haven't done the intro. Sorry. Yeah. Hi, everyone, and welcome to this week's episode of the worst girl gang ever. We are joined in our studios by the beautiful Claire Lynch.
Welcome,
Claire.
Oh, thank you for having me.
No, not at all. We've already established that it's going to be rough around the edges. No one's done any planning and Claire's not going to touch anything. She's just going to talk. So it should be a good one. So Claire, tell us, how did you become to be a member of the worst girl gang ever?
Yeah, well, what a privilege it is to be part of that gang. I think I'm part of that gang, or I hope I'm part of your gang. My wife, Bethan, and I, we went through that kind of people say fertility journey, don't they, which makes it sound more jolly than I think it is. It wasn't really a journey, was it? Like a kind of hellish gauntlet of that for about 5-6 years in total. So we went through quite a few cycles of IUI and then many more cycles of IVF, and so I guess all of those sort of small losses along the way, the first kind of way in. And then, you know, one of the things I've written about is that I had a miscarriage when we'd gone through a cycle of reciprocal IVF. I'm glad to be of service. Reciprocal IVF is where a same-sex couple, where two women in a couple, one of the couple's eggs is fertilized and then transferred to the other woman in the couple.
Okay.
So everyone sort of has a part in the actual biology of it.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. So you're kind of both going through the IVF in one sense. One of you is the egg collection, then one of you is like receiving on the transfer day.
Yeah.
So we'd gone through kind of done various kind of versions. And then finally, basically that there was a, I suppose that miscarriage was a kind of turning point for us actually. And we decided then to like reverse our roles in the process. Okay. So, you know, I think it's kind of one of the reasons I just really wanted to talk to you, because I just admire so much what you do with your podcast, with your courses and everything. And I think for me, that was a moment of deciding, did I want to be pregnant or did I want to be a mum? Mm. And so, you know, I think that kind of decision is something not lots of people talk about. You know, like what that means, it can mean different things for different people. But yeah, that was the kind of turning point really for us. So, you know, it then, I suppose, was a kind of restart, really. But I guess that's one of the things that I think is so interesting. It's never really a restart, is it? Those kind of things don't, you know, the experiences kind of don't disappear. So I'm kind of interested, I suppose, in a lot of like, what's your, where you kind of end up after those processes, however it kind of turns out in the end. I think you're always changed by that process.
I think you carry a lot with you as well, don't you? I think it's a lot like pregnancy after loss, when people almost treat that as a closed chapter of, oh, all that nasty business of the losses is gone now, it's done. Here's a fresh new chapter. And then people are surprised when the overwhelming feeling is not joy. When you find out you're pregnant, you expect, or people expect you, or the common misconception, so we say, is that it's just this absolute relief and joy of being pregnant after loss. But actually, you're still holding all that emotion, all that anxiety from what you've been through on your journey. And that it changes you, doesn't it? As you say, Claire, it absolutely changes you, and you carry forward what you've learned and how you've seen things, and that's completely natural. So I think you're really right in saying, you know, it's not you don't start again ever. You move forward, but you can't move on.
Yeah, I think that's right. It's a complicated thing, isn't it, really? And I think I'm sort of, you know, I'm very kind of conscious talking to you and thinking about who, you know, who might be listening, and thinking, I'm you know, I never want to tell that story that's like, oh, it all ends up happily in the end. You know, and it, you know, we have ended up having children, and it has ended up, you know, it has ended up happily in the end. But I think it's not to say that, you know, those kind of experiences are still, you know, they're part of the whole, aren't they? It's not like that thing ends and then, you know, the fairy tale kind of happens. I think we don't talk about that enough, really. And I think for a lot of people who are in the middle of it right now, you know, I think it's so powerful to kind of, you know, allow a bit of space for that, to say, you know, that's going to be part of it, you know, in some ways, in very good ways, you know, feeling that there is a sort of, whatever happens to you, you know, that's a, you know, a valuable kind of part of the narrative of your experience. But I don't think it just gets, you know, erased.
It's, I feel an analogy. Mm-hmm. Right. I love them, but I've really struggled.
Bring it. I love an analogy. Come on.
All right. It's like the storm. So you can have the most horrendous storm. And then after the storm, you might be feeling like, you know, that everything's okay because the sun's shining and it's calm and the sea's calmed down and stuff. But there's still all the devastation that the storm has wreaked. That is in so many ways irreparable, with the trees and the you know, some of it, like the buildings and that are destroyed, they can be fixed. And a lot of what you've been through can be repaired. But you will always have that natural stuff, the trees and the all the stuff that's been blown away that can't be repaired. It will always be there, and it will change. You'll get used to it being this, the new shapes and the new feelings, and it will change in intensity, but it will always be there.
That's not a bad one.
That's not a bad one, is it?
We've had some really shoddy ones.
No, but I mean, that was good. Yeah, it's at least a B+, that one. I mean, it's very good. I mean, I think, yeah, it is true. And I think that was kind of... That sort of kind of, in my experience anyway, that sort of sense in which you think it's all kind of fine, and then it kind of comes back up when you're like least expecting it, really. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I absolutely thought it was these were experiences that I'd processed or kind of moved past, and it didn't really matter anymore. But even things like, you know, writing the book, it was kind of fine. But when I had to go into the studio and record the audio book, when I got to that bit of the book, I mean, the poor sound engineer had to like go and discreetly make himself a cup of tea while I had a little ball for myself in the recording studio, because it, saying it out loud or reading it out loud kind of was bringing it back in a way that I hadn't anticipated. And I think that must be true for a lot of people, that, you know, whether you've, you know, made a different decision to kind of go forward with your life in a different way, whether you've had children, whatever the kind of next part of your story is, I think there'll always be those things that kind of, you know, just spark it off again, won't there? Or, you know, and how we talk about that, like letting people have that, is quite important, I think. Otherwise, you know, otherwise I think it can become, you know, a little bit dangerous, actually, to have that bubbling under the surface instead of just talking about it.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I think we get people around us in our lives expect us to have completely moved on. And you've certainly shared this before, Bex, about how you can be a little bit down one day and someone says, "What's up with you?" And you're like, "Oh, well, I'm still dealing with that. Like, it's not easy. Even a lot of people, when they have a pregnancy, a successful pregnancy, will still be triggered by announcements afterwards. And it's just allowing that space and understanding to, that people will still have these struggles and these difficult emotions. But Claire, I wanted to go back to something you said a bit earlier about feeling like you want to be careful about what you talk about to this community, because it's something that I've really struggled with, and you as well, Bex, haven't you? Imposter syndrome a little bit. I have too written a book.
Have you?
Yeah, I don't know if I'd mentioned it before.
No, never.
And I felt really, I don't know, like a bit guilty, a bit awkward about sharing my story, my journey, with people who were still in the midst of it, like people who are still in that shitty dark place, not knowing where to turn and what's gonna and how the story is gonna end. But I felt like it was so important to, I don't know about you, I couldn't have shared that stuff before I had my son. I would not have been able to have the courage, and you tell me off for saying that, Bex, but that's how it feels. Like I didn't feel strong enough, or didn't feel, I don't know, supported enough, or feel like it was a safe enough space for me to share that devastating experience until I had my happy ending, which I don't know. Was that the case for you? Did you write and share about this sort of stuff while you were going through it?
Yeah, no, I mean, I'm despite being a person who is, you know, I'm happy it turns out to kind of write this stuff in a book, but, you know, I'm not a very sharing kind of a person in real life. So I think there are a lot of people who, you know, who know me and found out some of this experience only when the book came out, kind of thing, you know. So I think I felt exactly the same. And, you know, actually the book kind of had, you know, stages where it was nearly coming out and then didn't quite work out, and then time would pass, and all of that, I think, was, as it turned out, really necessary, because I got far enough away from it, I think, in terms of time and experience, I then felt like I could get it down on paper. I think it is interesting, because I think it comes from a place of kind of knowing how that can kind of kick you in the guts when you're going through it, and you're trying not to do that to somebody else.
Yeah.
But I do think you're also trying to say, you know, the more stories out there, the kind of, I mean, I think that's a space of hope as well, isn't it? You know, it doesn't mean that everyone has the same ending, but you're still saying there are endings, right?
Yeah.
And I think when you're in it, that's kind of useful. I mean, I'm like really in awe of the people I see on Instagram who are kind of sharing their, you know, IVF cycles, like, you know, today I'm on, you know, day whatever, and I'm amazed by it, to be honest, because that's people are doing that with such kind of hope and confidence
and vulnerability
that is something that is so far away. Like, I, you know, we weren't telling, you know, people very close to us, because I think, and maybe that speaks to, you know, like the longer you're in that, the more the reality is kind of clear to you, and the more you realize it's kind of, when it's never ending in good news, the idea of kind of bringing people into it and having other people kind of waiting for your news would have been really, to me, like, you know, just more pressure on it and too unbearable. But the people who are brave enough to do that, or kind of, I don't know, I think kind of strong enough to do that. I mean, I can only admire it, to be honest. But I mean, you know, I guess that's the thing, isn't it? Everyone's making decisions all the way through, aren't they, about how much they want it to be private, or how much they kind of are resilient to the whole process.
I think it helps people have different coping methods as well, don't they? For some people, writing and sharing, and lots of people have these anonymous Instagram accounts where they can share, but it's not known who they are. And that's probably a good thing to do for some people who are a bit nervous about opening up to, you know, the world that actually knows them.
And but, yeah, and yeah, so, I mean, I and I admire it because it takes each one of those, you know, I think the truth is when you're going through it, you know, each one of those, it's not abstract to you, is it? You're like, this one, you know, this is the one that's going to work. You're thinking this is the cycle that's kind of the one. So why not, you know, own that, I suppose, and kind of let yourself think it. I don't have anything other than admiration for that, but I think it is,
I think as well, it's all, every single person is different, and it's like the people that Laura was worried about that would say, oh, it's all right for you because you're there. Equally, there is other people who need to hear that because they need to know that Laura had so many miscarriages and losses and was and then went on to have a baby. You know, there are always going to be people who need you, and there are always going to be people who don't want that. And that's fine, because there are enough people now, I think, sharing their stories and sharing that everyone can be kind of, everyone's needs can be accommodated, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Every story, we say all the time, every experience, every story, every person's grief is completely valid. Just because someone has a child doesn't mean that what they went through wasn't devastating. And it's the same for people who already have children and then go on to have further losses. Obviously, it's different. The grief's different. The dynamics are different. There are different layers to it. But it's still valid.
Mm.
Yeah, it's still valid. And I think you don't know, really, do you, who your stories will reach and kind of what the impact will be. And so I think kind of, you know, it's been really a sort of, yeah, I mean, a surprising thing for me, but a kind of really important thing for me, that often it's kind of, you know, people in same-sex relationships who kind of, you know, want that story to exist because they want to know that that's a possibility for them. Or, you know, often there's a kind of misconception that people who are, you know, like that gay couples don't have fertility issues, you know, that there's a kind of sense that you just kind of sign up to the IVF clinic and swipe the credit card, come home with a baby, you know. So I think, you know, you're often not prepared, I think, to kind of know who needs the story that you've got to tell.
Yeah. I guess with what you've just said about same-sex couples, it's kind of, in my mind, I mean, I wouldn't have necessarily thought of same-sex couples having fertility issues, because you kind of think that being in a same-sex relationship, there's your issue, because you can't have a baby the inverted commas normal way. So you kind of assume that that's the issue, but once you're past that, obviously, all you need to do is IVF, right? Because it's quite inconceivable.
It comes in,
to imagine that you would have more problems on top of that. It just seems so unfair. You know, you just feel like, there you go, over that hump.
Yeah.
Daisy, there's a baby. Let's go.
I know. I mean, you know, I'm sure, you know, there are people who manage that. But I mean, you know, just to be kind of logical, you know, that you've got the same stuff going on with your, you know, undiagnosed kind of fertility issues, or being gay doesn't mean you get to avoid like the womb scraping or the, you know, the same levels of, you know, egg reserve, whatever the things are going to be the same, aren't they? Yeah. And in a sense, you could say that very often, you know, if you think of those kind of terrible cliche things that people say, like, oh, well, you know, you can always try again. Yeah. Or you might get lucky, you know, it might be a happy accident. That's kind of not going to happen, right? So it can be to some degree worse, right? Because you've only got the IVF, might be the only chance. And if you live in a place where you're not going to get that funded, or you've only got enough money to cover those, you know, maybe the one or two cycles and that money runs out, you know, there isn't a kind of, oh, let's see what happens over the next few years, like chance up your sleeve kind of thing. So, you know, that sort of thinking about how we view people. I mean, I know in terms of the idea of loss, often it's the first time that people realize that someone in a same-sex couple is trying for a baby, right? Because then, you know, you might make assumptions about a kind of a straight couple, or, you know, you might think, oh, you've been married for so long, maybe now they're going to have a baby. It might only be when someone has to announce loss that suddenly it's kind of a shock to everyone that they were even trying. You know, so you got kind of all of that to sort of work around as well.
Did you find, were people supportive? Were there any people didn't say to you, you can always, you know, happy accident and all of that sort of stuff?
What did support look like for you when you...
Mm.
Yeah, sorry, thanks. That's a shit question.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think people were supportive. I think, I mean, when I think about it now, I think we were very... you know, I'm not sure we like opened ourselves up to much support in a way. You know what I mean? I think kind of my response was very kind of closing down. And I mean, I'm not kind of using this language lightly, but, you know, but going a little bit insane for a short amount of time, you know, so all of that kind of stuff, I'm not sure that it's kind of fair to even, you know, it wasn't that the support wasn't there so much as we didn't let the support come. Maybe that's part of it too. But I mean, I think certainly what was missing, and I hope that maybe people could try and, you know, think about a little bit more, certainly when we were then, you know, in the kind of pregnancy after loss, you know, stage of things, we were announcing that, you know, that my partner was pregnant, people would kind of very casually say things to me like, oh, well, you know, that's, you're getting out of all the hard work, or, you know, when are you going to have a go then, or this kind of casual, as if it was, you know, literally one of the neighbors said, oh, did you toss a coin to decide who would have the baby? That kind of, which in the context of not knowing that you'd gone through years of kind of loss, you know, but even not, you know, knowing or not knowing, I suppose the idea that we think of pregnancy as being so easily achieved, you know, by anyone.
Yeah.
You know, and then if, when we say things like that, what we're doing is kind of, you know, almost inevitably putting our foot in it, right? So, you know, it
diminishes everything that someone's been through, and loss or no loss, IVF is grueling, and without IVF as well, even just trying to conceive is fucking hard.
Yeah exactly. So I think that's kind of, but it is revealing, I think, that when people if you assume that's easy and you assume it's straightforward, you know, then those kind of like throwaway comments or kind of jokes about it seem totally reasonable, I suppose.
Yeah.
But it doesn't take much to kind of think, you know, maybe that's not.
No.
It's a weird reaction, isn't it, to that news as well, I think.
But I think once you're in the baby loss community, then it becomes something that you can know that you will no longer just bypass you with.
Yeah.
How many times we heard comments, who knows how many, I know I personally made a lot of comments, starting with at least before I'd experienced loss myself, because without the emotional understanding behind the pain of loss, we can't understand it from an emotional perspective. But what we can do, I don't know if you heard me, is that we can teach it. We can teach people to understand that it's not appropriate to ask a same-sex couple whether they tossed a coin to decide who would carry their baby.
Yeah,
because it's not something. It was that a man who asked you that?
No, it wasn't actually. No, I mean, it was quite an elderly woman, so we didn't kind of throw down about it. But I mean, it's coming from a place of, you know, honestly kind of wondering, how is it in a same-sex couple that you make that decision, right? It's coming from that place. It's coming from, I wonder how, you know, you have that discussion, or what would that, and no one's quite ready over the garden fence to ask it like in that way, right? But yeah, I mean, I think, you're totally right.
It might also be coming from a place of someone trying to go, hey, I'm okay with same-sex couples. I'm going to make it really light and funny.
Yeah, yeah.
You don't think that I am a homophobe.
No, and in fact, we did toss a coin. So, no, we didn't toss a coin, but like...
How about just saying congratulations, how are you feeling?
I mean, it's another way to go, isn't it?
I was going to ask you, Claire, was there ever a point when you were going through the devastation of and the darkness of the uncertainty and the loss and stuff, was there a point where you considered stopping?
Yes, there was a point, but, and I'm not really proud of this, I have to say, I got to a point of being absolutely kind of that it was the only way. Like, I became very kind of, you know, because once you're sort of so far in a certain number of years, you know, I was doing any extra test they would offer or any extra kind of procedure, you know, some sort of intravenous kind of thing I remember having after one positive, you know, like all sorts of, you know, they could have said to me, you know, we need to like strip the wiring out of your house because it's the only one thing that's going to help. And I would have said, yeah, go ahead. Or, you know, we're going to have to amputate a leg. I would have said yes to whatever it takes. I was too far in, actually.
Yeah.
I think at one point, like too kind of, and so it's why I think, you know, with all the kind of benefit of retrospect, that I'm really glad actually that it worked out in the way that it did, because I think I had like lost sight a little bit of what the point was. And the point was that we were trying to have a family. The point was not to sort of pass the test of IVF.
Yeah. I can relate to that. For me, it was an obsession about getting pregnant and staying pregnant. I hadn't actually, when I was pregnant, I started freaking out towards the end of it. Cause I was like, shit, a baby.
Yeah.
I'd spent 7 years waiting for this baby.
Yeah.
But I was just petrified of it, or petrified of not being able to look after it, because I hadn't even considered that step. But it is obsessive, isn't it?
Yeah, it is obsessive. It is kind of a, again, I don't mean to, I'm not using this language kind of, you know, like lazily. I think it is a kind of addiction that, you know, thinking of it that way, also kind of that you're sort of lost to it, or you're willing to do anything, or, you know, I mean, I think there were quite a few times where we sort of tried to have a little pause and say, you know, like, what would life be like if we didn't carry on with this? You know, you know, it would be fine, right? There'd be like other lives you can live. And I'm really kind of keen on people being allowed to sort of, you know, again, like talk about that and have space for that and say it's not the only solution to like being an adult or whatever. I don't know what that kind of driving force is, or, you know, there's other ways to kind of be. And I think people who do have children have got quite a responsibility actually to not make out that their way of life is so kind of like, I don't know, is the superior path. Do you know what I mean? I think it's very important actually to kind of think about, you know, not presenting it that way and not living your life as if that's kind of all there is, because I think it also, that's kind of doing damage to people who are making other choices or having to kind of make other choices, whichever way.
Yeah. We had a lady called Katie Seppi on the podcast a few weeks back, and our chat with her was really interesting. She is childless, not by choice, and runs this whole community for people, whether they've been on infertility journeys or are single and never found the right person. And she was just quite inspirational to chat to. She went through a lot, but decided to stop. And what was interesting was that there are many people who go through everything, every option, and they keep going. And they might try donor eggs, or they might try surrogacy, you know, spend all of their money. And it's a bit like you say, an addiction. It's a bit of a gamble, isn't it, with IVF? It is like a gambling addiction. But she is a great support to that community. So anyone who's listening that that is thinking about stopping or wants to see what life looks like without children, then do go and listen to that episode.
I mean, not to be, you know, the head girl, but I did listen to that episode as well. So, and I thought, yeah, it was brilliant. And I think it was exactly that sort of, what I thought was so good is that, you know, she'd been able to really kind of make that decision on her own terms, hadn't she? And I think when you're right in the middle of, you know, thinking, oh, you know, just one more cycle might be the one, what if I could just change the drug protocol a tiny bit, if they just gave me, you know, it's so hard to sort of see beyond it. You almost need to have that, you know, do that thinking before it starts, don't you? You know, a little bit of, you know, all of the options on the table a bit before you kind of get too far in that you can't.
Yeah, that's what we've done this time, trying again. We've set a deadline on it, and we've got such a limited amount of money as well, so whatever comes first, that time deadline or that money deadline. And because that's a possibility, I'm thinking about it and come to terms with it. So it's not going to be like a massive shock if it doesn't
happen. Yeah. Yeah, we had to make a similar sort of decision when we had a frozen embryo. We had to decide, you know, a couple of years down the line, would we go back, if you like, for her, as it turned out. And it was really difficult, actually, because in a way it wasn't difficult, because, you know, you felt like that's already been kind of, you know, a lot of the hard work is done, and the kind of feeling that it's the potential is there, and you don't want to sort of not find out. But we really had to kind of do that thinking of, if that doesn't work, are we willing to kind of get into all of that again?
Mm-hmm.
You know, because once you know what you're really in for, do you want to like really give yourself another version of that for however many years or whatever?
Yeah, exactly. So you had two successful pregnancies, is that right?
Yeah, two successful pregnancies, three children. So we had twins first, and then we have 6-year-old twins and a 3-year-old.
You didn't have them when they were 6 years old.
No, we had them exactly. Yeah, we did. We said, can we collect them when they're already walking and talking, potty trained?
Yeah. So you're all girls. You're a proper girl.
We're all girls. Yeah, we do have a boy hamster.
Okay.
Yeah, the cat's a girl as well. Yeah, they like to tell people we're a girl family. Oh, yeah, but apart from Cupcake, who is the one masculine influence in our house, but he's called Cupcake.
Very manly name.
Yeah. his middle name is Gerald, so, you know.
Bruce or something.
Exactly.
And what, Claire, we talked a bit at the beginning about your book, but now let's really talk about your book. So what made you write it? What is it about? And how
it's already out, isn't it?
It's already out. Yeah, it's already out. It's just recently the paperback came out. So it's called Small on Motherhoods. And it's that little kind of S is quite important, really, because I think it's the two motherhoods of our family. But also, you know, I'm really interested in the kind of motherhood is not like this singular thing, is it? It's a kind of thing that's changing. It's a thing that I think, you know, I feel really strongly that we were in that kind of anticipatory motherhoods, or kind of we were, you know, all of that effort of kind of getting there,
yeah,
is part of it too, you know. I don't think it kind of begins when children are born or, you know, anything like that. I think that sort of, and thinking about all the mothers that we kind of you know, like are around, the book is really about from the trying to have them and then the early kind of years of being parents. So, you know, you spend a lot of time with other mothers in, you know, mostly like sitting on the floor singing Wind the Bobbin Up or whatever, like in that kind of early stage, or, you know, in the, all of our children were born prematurely, especially the twins. So being like in the intensive care unit with them when they were tiny little things. I think it's about the kind of a change of perspective, like noticing the small things in life a bit more, not hopefully in such a cheesy way as that, but, you know, kind of seeing, you know, the experiences of becoming a family, I think, forcing a new sense of kind of how you fit into things in the world, or like what, you know, there's a lot of reimagining your own place in things when you're then thinking about these small people. That's kind of part of it, really.
Yeah,
that's so cool. I think, like, as you were kind of saying earlier, the landscape of motherhood is so big. There's so much in it that I think it's ever changing and ever kind of developing. And I think we need to recognize, I think all mothers need to recognize that just because we're doing things differently, we're not doing things incorrectly. And I think there's so much weight in the fact that you're never going to be the same as anyone else. I just think on the narrative of motherhood is so outdated, like, you know, the classic motherhood narrative. And we need to get people to understand that if they're not conforming to this antiquated motherhood concept, it doesn't mean that they're not doing it.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think that's so, so important to teach. And then, you know, like working mums and stay-at-home mums, all that stuff just needs to be ditched.
Yeah, yeah.
There is no longer, and there shouldn't have been back then, but there was, and we'll forget about that because we can't change it. There is no longer an archetype for motherhood that we should all be following.
No.
That is a massive thing that people need to understand and realise. And if they can't understand it, they just need to accept it.
Yeah, I think you're right. And I think, you know, one of the things I've written about is when we were at, you know, going to antenatal classes, you know, the teacher was like, right, well, mums go to this end of the room and dads go to this end of the room. And I'd just be standing in the middle like, don't know, where do you want me kind of thing, you know? And very much had this idea still of like the, you know, what mums and dads do, or that, you know, the pregnancy and birth being something that almost needed to be kind of kept from partners. And it was a bit sort of, you know, private somehow and should be kind of.
We watched Called a Midwife and they weren't even allowed in the room, were
yeah,
they?
But I mean, this is, you know, it's not that long ago. I mean, I'm glad that you're looking at me now on Zoom and thinking, you know, Call the Midwife, not like 6 years ago, right? But it's kind of, it's kind of interesting too, like, you know, thinking about, I think that's also a thing that I was, you know, you get stuck in the fertility kind of industry sort of cycle, you can forget that there's the job to do afterwards, right? It's like putting all your effort into planning the wedding, but not thinking like,
yes,
how will my marriage be, right?
Yeah. You know, I was thinking that earlier, but I thought I'm analogied out for now.
You don't want to go, well, I'll take that on the analogy chart. Because, you know, you've got to think, well, you know, what kind of person do I want to be? Do I want to be a kind of miserable kind of husk of myself who can't, you know, live the life I want to live? Or do I want to be the kind of parent who is able to, you know, be the part of their lives that I want to be.
And sing Wind the Bobbin Up.
Get on the floor and sing Wind the Bobbin Up in the round. Yeah, I mean, that's who I want to be. Yeah.
No, just a tip for Wind the Bobbin Up for you. What we do is around our table now, we do it in different accents. And it's
That's nice.
Yeah, so Jamaican's my favourite. You got to wind that bobbin up, wind that bobbin up.
We might get complaints.
You can edit.
The other thing that we do is we say moo, as in a cow, moo, in different accents. And we all go around like, oh my gosh, it's a good game. Just, you can have that one on me.
Okay, I'm feeling like we're not really bringing enough to the sing-song table now. So, okay, right.
Like, do a Scottish moo. Go on, do
me,
that.
Me.
That's a bit Northern Irish, guys.
Oh, it was a bit Northern.
Moo,
moo.
God,
anyway,
it's gone downhill.
It's a great game. I recommend it.
One for dinner time. All right, I'm ready for it. Yeah,
absolutely.
So, Claire, where can people find your book?
They can find it wherever they find books. So it's in all bookshops and on online ones, you know. That one that you should buy books from, and all of the kind of, you know. But also, I should say that if you want to obviously hear me crying, you can get the audiobook on Audible, but I prefer you not to.
I tried to buy it a couple of weeks ago and it wouldn't let me.
What, the audio one?
Yeah.
Oh, well, maybe they thought it was too traumatic. They've taken it down.
Maybe my card bounced.
Well, I'm really looking forward to recording our audiobook. We've got that booked in.
Yeah, you're not going to cry though, are you? You've got to be careful for that.
Oh, I will, 100%.
Yeah,
I'm the same as you.
With a doot.
I know, without a doubt.
Yeah, what accents are you going to do it in?
It's what you were saying earlier about. I know that there's part of stuff that I went through that I haven't processed, because every time we start talking about it, I cry, and then I just have. Try and pull myself together. Maybe I'll deal with that one day.
But, you know, yeah, but that's the that's the reason it's worth doing as well, isn't it, to be honest? You know, like if it's
therapy. Yeah.
Well, yeah, and I mean, you know, it's the truth, isn't it? So,
yeah,
you know, like that's what it's like. I mean, but, you know, I can highly recommend the mint tea is what they try and give you in the audiobook, like your Beyonce or something, and you need a mint tea to...
I put my nose up at a peppermint tea this morning.
Oh, well, you're never going to make it in the audiobook.
Oh, no.
Okay.
Session without it.
Regular as well, apparently.
Well, you know, all of the benefits.
Oh, dear.
My mate used to work in a post office. This is completely unrelated.
Okay.
My mate used to work in a post office, and so someone bought a box of bran flakes, and he said to her, "That'll keep you regular." It was like an older lady, and he got fired.
Oh dear!
Wow.
Didn't take a joke.
No post office banter. No.
No.
Wow.
I've always fancied myself as a postwoman. They've always got really tanned legs, haven't they?
Yeah, shorts all year round. It's a year round shorts job. Anyway, enough of this nonsense. Claire, thank you so much for joining us. It's been lovely to chat to you, and I'm definitely going to read your book.
I'm going to listen to it.
Well, I'll definitely read your book as well. That's a fair deal.
Okay, deal.
And we will include all the links and everything in the show notes so that people can just click and go to that website and buy it.
Brilliant.
And
hopefully if their cards aren't declined.
Yes.
Yeah, that's awkward. Oh, okay. Well, thank you for having me. It's been lovely to chat.
No worries. Yeah,
all right. I'll try out that wind the bobbin up.
Yeah, just get in and get on.
And move.
Yeah, I'll send you a voice note. Yeah.
Woo! That was Welsh.
Really? Oh dear, I've got to work with her for the rest of the day.
Okay. Good luck.
All right.
Thanks.
Bye.
See you later. Cheers.
Bye. Thank you so much, everyone, for tuning in. And please, please, when you have a second, rate us, review us, and share us. And let's get this taboo smashed. See you next week.